Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 4th of December 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at RadioAlbion.com, because normally we would have Dennis Wise here, the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, but unfortunately he is still ill. I have spoken to him during the week and he is on the mend. His condition is improving. He still has some treatment to go, which he is waiting for, but he's gradually getting his strength back. He was in a good mood when I spoke to him, and he thanks everyone for their prayers. He says it was his faith that really helped him get through it. He was in some really dark places over the last few weeks, but he certainly seems to be coming around now and on the mend. So that's a bit of great news to begin the podcast with. And I also have good news about our guest today. We have Horace coming back, who was here last week telling us about his presentations on the Second World War, and this week he is here to discuss ideas about Professor Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique series. Now, I've read the Culture of Critique book itself. Horace has read Culture of Critique, and he's also read Separation and Its Discontents. And there's also a first book, which we're going to get into a little bit today. Neither of us has actually read it, but the ideas that are in that book, we're both quite well aware of. So I'm very grateful for Horace for coming back today. And I know he's a big fan of Kevin MacDonald. Thank you very much for coming on, Horace. How are you doing today?
It's great to be back on, man. I really enjoyed it last week, and I'll take it as a good sign that I'm back. So thanks for having me back. And I wish Dennis well. I hope he's recovering well.
Yeah, it's really good news to hear that he's getting through this and he's on the mend. And you sent me over a list of the books that you'd been studying last week. Quite an impressive selection that you had there. It was quite difficult to pick one. And then I thought, well, Culture of Critique, I have at least read that one, so we could get into that. And then I thought, well, why not do all three of them, really? Because we can also talk a little bit about Kevin MacDonald here as well, because when he started writing these books, he was quite a philo-Semite at first. He was very, very impressed with the Jews, the fact that they had managed to keep themselves together as a cohesive unit through thousands of years whilst living amongst other nations. And all the while, that was the way that he was looking at things. Everything was okay. In actual fact, Amazon still stock his first book. And then as he was studying the Jews, he discovered that some of the things that had happened hadn't happened in quite the way that he had thought that they did. And gradually, by the time he got to Culture of Critique, he was looking at some of the things that were going on, some of the political movements that were happening, and the promotion of immigration into America. And he was seeing that massive changes to society that had been brought about by these Jewish intellectual movements, and the fact that we can't study them, we can't really talk about them because we get accused of being anti-Semites, that formed a large part of this as well in his second book, which I know you've had a good read of. But his first book, really, he explains what he's actually doing here, which is studying group evolutionary strategy, which is basically the way that a group develops ways of dealing with life. And the Jews themselves were living amongst another nation rather than living on their own. So they had lots of things that they had to cope with. They were an in-group and they were living amongst an out-group. And over the years, they developed ways of keeping themselves together as that in-groups and not assimilating. They developed ways of increasing their wealth, basically from transferring wealth from the out-group to the in-group. There's nothing wrong with doing this. They're just trying to do the best for their group. But the ways that they actually do this are fascinating. And that's basically group evolutionary strategy. And it's not just applied to Jews. You can apply it to women in the way that women get by in society. They have a much lower body strength than men. They have to protect children a lot more. And when they're pregnant, they're at a lot more risk. They can't physically defend themselves at all. So they've developed strategies of of getting by in life that is to the benefit of women as a group, and Jews have developed ways of getting by in life which is of benefit to them as a group. I don't know if you'd like to add anything to that, Horace, any ideas on that brief intro there?
No, I don't think I can add much. I think that when it comes to addressing like the questions from like Kevin MacDonald's field, evolutionary psychology, I sort of defer to him as the expert. So what he says, I'll take that as something I haven't really got any grounds on which to challenge that. So I assume he's right about that, you know.
Well, yeah, definitely. There are people that have tried to challenge him. There are academics that have questioned what he's doing, and he has answered this. And the Jewish advocacy groups have said, no, it shouldn't even be discussed. It shouldn't even be discussed. But, yeah, you know, if what he's saying is wrong, then somebody needs to show that it is wrong, and they need to have a debate about this. Why is it a subject that cannot be talked about? And of course, the Jews will say, well, it can't be talked about because it inspires pogroms. But, you know, we're living in the 21st century. There's not going to be a pogrom if we talk about this. And talking about it, you come to understand the reason why people behave in the way that they do. It's only if we look at everybody as being exactly the same and try to judge them as if they were ourselves that we get into these problems. I was suggesting to you just before we went on air, Horace, about how it seems to me that the thing that most messed things up was trying to Christianize the Jews. And that really offended them. They didn't want to be Christians. They were Jews. They were separate to us, and we were trying to change them and trying to get them to assimilate and trying to get them to be like ourselves. And that was a big mistake, and it used up a lot of resources, and it's something that the Jews are still not happy about. And it basically boils down to assuming that they're the same as us. And, you know, I think they're correct in that. They're not the same as us, and they have every right to not want to be Christianized. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, but one that I can't answer, that how and why Jews developed this intense and like seemingly eternal desire to stay separate. But yeah, it seems to me that the Christian project, and I assume this is only come from some Christians, but the project of trying to convert or assimilate the Jews, and essentially to, you know, from their point of view, annihilate their identity, is, I mean, misguided, and also I think idiotic. I think it's based on a misunderstanding of, like, separateness seems to me to be at, and I think this is what Kevin MacDonald's arguing, at the very core of what it means to be a Jew. It is just to continue being a Jew, not to be assimilated. And I think MacDonald emphasizes that in all three books, actually. I remember him doing so in Culture of Critique as well. It's absolutely at the heart of what it means to be Jewish.
Yeah, and to try and change that, it means attacking what they very are. So right from the start, we can say that is, you know, that was a bad move by the Christians trying to Christianize the Jews. But getting back to this first book of Kevin MacDonald's, the cover of the book says, the book attempts to understand an ancient people in terms of modern evolutionary biology. A basic idea is that Judaism itself is a group evolutionary strategy, what one might term an evolutionarily significant way for a group of people to get on in the world. The book documents several theoretically interesting aspects of group evolutionary strategies using Judaism as a case study. And he's talking specifically about the religion there. And of course, the religion itself doesn't seek to proselytize. It may have done in the past, over 2,000 years ago, but since rabbinic Judaism came about, it does not seek to proselytize. It is a religion for a specific group of people, and that helps to keep them within that group of people. It means that others aren't trying to join that group of people. So that's a help for a start. Now, it has a list of the subjects that he covers here. And the first one is genetic cohesion of Judaism, how the Jews managed to erect and enforce barriers to gene flow between themselves and other peoples. And of course, they had these marriage laws within their religion to say that they couldn't marry out of that religion. They could only marry other Jews. So for a start, that prevented the gene flow between them and others. And as they grew over time. Once we get up to about the 17th, the 18th century, then there were selective marriages with selective Gentiles. So you had Gentiles that were in the aristocracy, and some of these Jewesses, the particularly attractive ones, would then marry the rich members of the Gentile aristocracy. And then because of the law that they had, which meant that the children would be Jewish, it meant that the children of that offspring would then be Jewish. And the later generations of that family that had previously been a high up part of the British or the European aristocracy were then Jews that were in that position. So this was a very, very effective strategy of the Jews. And I'm not saying that that's in a negative way. It's worked very well for them. It meant that they could have more influence in our societies. But originally, when it first started off, when they were first separated by the Romans from their temple and they were separated from their land, they had these very, very strict laws to prevent them from marrying out. And Professor MacDonald talks about that in this first book here. But I guess most of us are more aware of the fact that they've married into the aristocracy now, because this is why we see things like David Cameron, whose great-great-grandfather was a Jew. Boris Johnson, I think he's got a great-great-grandfather who is a Jew. And we see lots of our aristocracy now have partial Jewish heritage. So they therefore are going to have sympathies with the Jews, more sympathies than somebody who didn't have that heritage might have, which is of benefit to the Jews again. So this has been an evolutionary strategy of theirs to do both, in actual fact, to stay marrying within their own and also to marry with the Gentiles as well. Do you want to comment on that, Horace?
Yeah, I mean, another example would be George Osborne. He's got some Jewish ancestry. And also Keir Starmer, his wife is Jewish and they're raising their children Jewish. There's also people like Brian Stelter on CNN, same thing. They're born Gentiles, but by their relationship choices and stuff, become effective converts or servants of the Jewish cause. But yeah, and MacDonald in Separation of Discontents discusses that as being an especially acutely pursued practice in Spain. Quite a large section of that book concerns Spain, but I think we might come on to that shortly.
Yeah, we'll get into that as well, and the Spanish Inquisition. And I was just thinking there as well with Donald Trump, with his daughter Ivanka. She's married Jared Kushner, and of course Jared Kushner is very highly placed in the administration, and this is through marriage. But as I say, it wasn't always like that. It's only been the last couple of hundred years that they've really changed things around and allowed this selective marriage. In Israel, you cannot marry, Jews can't marry unless it's to another Jew. They can't marry Arabs, and they also have DNA tests before people can get into Israel, before Jews from outside of Israel can go into Israel. They have to have DNA tests. So it's very, very frowned upon.
Verified Jews. Yeah.
Verified Jews.
It's one other interesting thing is that in America, it's quite different. I mean, there is perhaps by their standards, a remarkably high level of interbreeding with other races now, because it turns out quite a lot of black people, like mixed race black people, have a bit of Jewish ancestry, or maybe like Steven Seagal, who I think is at least half Jewish. He had a Japanese, so he's got a Japanese. He had a Japanese wife and had a child with her. So there is quite like maybe historically a high amount of outbreeding in American Jews now. I'm not really sure, but it seems that way.
Yeah, the black Jews, I think that would come down to the slave owners. And I think a lot of Jewish blood made its way into the blacks over there through them being owned by Jewish owners. I think that's one aspect of it that it doesn't get very much talked about. The second heading here is resource competition between Jews and non-Jews. So you've got the group of Jews there. They've just left their homeland and they haven't got anything with them apart from their wealth. And they didn't have lands in the lands that they moved to. So what could they do? Well, they were involved in tax farming and they were involved in money lending because they couldn't produce things of their own so much. And they didn't really have a history of being farmers or anything like that. They resorted to money lending, which made them a lot of money, especially through usury, through interest on top. But of course, this upsets the Gentiles, because the Gentiles didn't have money lending with interest on top before, and until these Jews came in. And of course that set up a divide between the people and the kings, because the kings were benefiting from this. And when the Jews died, all the money from the Jews that they'd made from the usury would go to the king. So the king was making a cut from this, basically, but the peasants were getting bled dry in a lot of instances. So you had resource competition here, and the way that the Jews managed to gain resources was through money lending rather than through trade or producing things. And this was the source of much friction. And I would suggest that was really the source of the pogroms. But because of the Jews, because that's the natural way that they do things, is money lending, that's what they've always done, it seems irrational to them that somebody is going to attack them for doing this. But it's because it comes naturally to them to do that, but it doesn't come naturally to us. And we never had any history of usury. I can't think of the historian it was. I think it was a Roman historian that mentioned this, that amongst the Germanic tribes, there was no lending at interest. And that was the same with the Britons as well. They weren't lending at interest. It was something that came about in the Roman Empire through the Jews. And this was the way that they got their resources, basically, was through doing this. So again, you've got instant friction and conflict there is through usury. Do you want to comment on the Jews and usury, Horace?
Yeah, I think it might have been Tacitus who was the Roman historian. He wrote the Germania. But I don't have a clear position on usury, because I think that lending if you lend £100 and get £100 back, that's kind of mad, because you've lost the use of that money and risked losing the whole amount, and you get back the same amount. That's a loss, you know. That's in economics, in my understanding of economics, you've actually lost out because you lost the use of that money and you put it at risk. So I think lending at some interest is rational. It's quite a natural sort of outcome of the market. But I mean, the way in which Jews either were employed by monarchs, essentially against the people, if a foreign tribe who believes themselves to be chosen or in some sense superior to the people that they're taxing, or in other ways, profiting from through some sort of monopoly or monopoly charter or something that the king might grant, that is obviously going to lead to predatory, exploitative lending and finance. The story of pogroms and crimes, violent crimes against Jews as a community. I intend to do a video on this at some point, but I've got to do a lot of research first. But it seems to me that in most of those cases, probably not every one, but there was a specific provocation. That doesn't justify visiting crimes upon people who haven't done anything wrong, who are just part of the same ethnic group. But all the same, it is very dishonest to tell the story as just a history of the Gentiles, lashing out at the Jews for no reason, or this notion of the, quote, virus of anti-Semitism. No. It's a two-way thing. It's an ongoing ethnic conflict. And, a mixture of justified and unjustified things happen.
I think it's a compound interest. That's where the problems come in. I mean, you're quite right there. I mean, if somebody's going to loan out some money for a business venture, then they should be able to expect to make some kind of profit from it. And I think that was the system that we actually had. It wasn't interest. If you lent someone some money and it was for a business venture, you would get a certain percentage of the profits. If the business venture failed, then you would lose that money. Whereas with the Jewish version of lending, it didn't matter what the business venture was, what the profits were, whether it rained and you lost your crop, the Jews had to be paid, and it had to be this compound interest. And the compound interest, they would want to get like a little bit paid all the time, so that it was never able to actually be paid back. That's the magic of compound interest.
To keep you on the hook, right? Yeah. To keep a constant stream of money coming from you to me, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah, you're right there. I mean, it's the source of most of these pogroms. If you look into it in history, a large part of what happened was burning the ledgers, get hold of the Jews' ledgers and burn them. And then they can no longer keep getting this money off you all the time. And I guess it's the same as today. You know, the banks, they don't actually produce anything of value. They produce the money, they produce the currency in the form of a loan. And if somebody doesn't pay it back, they can then possess the property and they can possess the house. And so this comes into this resource competition here. The Jews would be producing the money. They actually got the tender to the Bank of England. So they were managing the ledger, basically, what the loans are, monetizing the loans. And then you've got the Gentiles building everything, building the houses, building the factories, building the infrastructure. And then when it doesn't get paid back, the bank repossesses it. So the Jews were able to make acquisitions of all these resources whilst not actually being the people that created the value. They created the currency, they managed the ledgers, but it was always the Gentiles that created the value. And our kings did try to actually teach them in quite a few different instances throughout history. They tried to, they would make usury illegal, they'd make it illegal to moneylend, and they would try to teach the Jews farming or metalworking or these other trades. And they just either refused to do it or they were incapable of doing it. If you read the Jews' own literature, they say they're incapable of doing it. They're just not capable of doing this work. If you read the religious literature, they frown on doing that work anyway. It's the lowest of the low is doing right. Manual labor. So again, there's religious part to this strategy of theirs.
And that attempt to get them to move into other trades, I mean, that is again, it seems to be an example of Christians or just Europeans, ethnic Europeans, failing to understand what kind of people they're dealing with. And dealing with a tribe that does not want to be assimilated. It's very, very explicit and important to them. So to try and get them to do so is just always misguided, I think. You have to accept them for what they are.
Yeah, that's a good point to make and to draw those two together. The next one, it says, how Jews managed to have a high level of charity within their communities, but at the same time, they prevented free riding. And I think what he's probably trying to get at here is the Jews required people to read the Talmud. And those who were reading the Talmud and became Talmudic scholars, they received charity. And they do in Israel today. You hear about these Talmudic scholars that have got these huge families and they don't have to go and fight in the military. And it is actually a source of discontent amongst the other Israelis there that they have to pay out so much money that goes on welfare to these Talmudic scholars. And I think you have the same situation in New York. So they prevented the free riding by saying that if you're going to get this welfare, it has to be because you're a Talmudic scholar, because you're reading the Talmud all the time. And again, that reinforces the sense of in-group and the out-group and that they are a part of this different group. So they are charitable to amongst their own people. And we can see they have a huge sense of loyalty to their own people. I mean, you can have Jews that are on the right-hand side of politics and Jews that are on the left-hand side of politics, and you'll see one of them gets criticized, and the Jews from the other side of politics will be supporting them. And they'll be saying, we totally understand what's going on, how terrible that you're being criticized. And that just goes for the whole of Judaism. It doesn't matter what side of politics they are, they will support one another. Is quite an admirable trait that we don't seem to have as whites, because we tend to be so much more individualist, whereas the Jews think in terms of the group all the time, and that takes precedence. Things such as which politics you are, right or left, that's not important. What is most important is that it's another Jew, and so that covers charity, I think. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, they will also, it seems to me, in politics, try to contain the range of acceptable narrative or the range of acceptable discussion within the range must stop at either end where things get bad for the Jews. So like the left position, it must be a left position consistent with Jewish interests or Jewish power, and the same on the right. So if necessary, the whole of politics will be truncated to achieve that. The whole of political debate will be truncated. So on the left, what's unacceptable is, you know, opposition to Israel and obviously any racial hatred towards Jews, but I actually think there's very little of that on the left. And on the right, obviously, nationalism is bad for Jews because it maintains and increases the power of nations. And Jews, it seems, collectively want to dissolve nations or white nations. Most of the nations in the world, but not Israel, obviously. What you said about the the Talmudic scholars being able to, you know, being supported by the rest of the community in welfare. Yeah, in Israel, I think it's like all of the ultra-Orthodox sect, which I don't particularly know what that refers to. I mean, obviously they're strongly Orthodox. But yeah, that, they are the ones who are exempted from military national service and, yeah, from having to work. They're able to live on welfare. And they are booming. Like in Israel, I think they're on course to become the majority of the population. Goodness knows what that portends for Israel. They could collapse the whole society, maybe. I mean, presumably they've got some solution in mind.
Yeah.
I first read about that in the book White Shift by Eric Kaufman. Maybe we could discuss that one another day.
Yeah, I've heard of that. I've heard of that. Is that a recent one?
Yeah, 2 or 3 years old, 3 or 4, yeah.
Yeah, we'll have
maybe.
Maybe
come back to that for another day.
Yeah, yeah. Number 4 here, how some groups of Jews came to have such high IQs. Now, this is, again, this comes down to these Talmud scholars bit. What we tend to have amongst Europeans is we would honour and idolise great warriors, and the great warriors would get to breed with the best women. Amongst Judaism, where they idolised these Talmud scholars, then they were the ones that got to breed with the most women and the best women. And it was the Talmud scholars got the social rewards, and where they're studying all the time. And when they've got their Kabbalah as well, which involves a lot of mathematics and a lot of abstract thinking. So you would end up with the highly intelligent people that were breeding and surviving into adulthood. Whereas amongst the Gentiles, you got the warrior types that were surviving into adulthood and that were getting the rich. So I think this resulted in a higher IQ, and I don't know for certain, but I think that's Kevin McDonald's explanation of the fact they have a higher IQ. Would you go along with that, Horace?
That sounds right to me. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely plausible, and I don't have any better explanation. I noticed I read a book by Gilad Atzmon. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's of Jewish ancestry himself, but he actually renounces his Jewish identity, calls himself an ex-Jew. But he writes very frankly and really, really interestingly about these things. And he says the same, that there's the Jewish cognitive elite dominates Jewry, and also tends to or comes to dominate the societies in which it settles and sort of reaches for power. And I can't fully explain the reasoning behind it, but I recommend people check out Gilad Atzmon's book. He talks about it as well. But yeah, the combination, I think, is really important. The combination of high IQ with the very, very intense, fervent ethnocentrism, that makes them immensely more powerful than the numbers would suggest. Incredibly so. And combined with, of course, the, I think, unique white tendency to positively go against ethnocentrism to a large extent and to consider it altruistic to be welcoming to outsiders, that makes us particularly vulnerable to that combination. So this is a large reason for the plight that we're in at the moment.
One of the things they most like to promote is multiculturalism and diversity. And you pointed out earlier about how it seems they're trying to destroy the other nations of the world. But the way that the Jews see it is, well, the more multiculturalism there is, the less the Jews stand out as being different. And the more they look like they're the same as the Gentiles. So it's of great benefit to them to have as many different races as possible within the country that they're living in. Obviously not in Israel, because that is their own country, that is their own homeland. But amongst the other nations, it's of great benefit to them, and that is one of the most important things to them, is to advocate for immigration. Which and another side of this as well, you pointed it out there. They're such a small group as well, a very, very small group. It would be so easy for them to be consumed by the out group, by the host nation that they are living among. They've got to try and find some way of gaining power because they're so weak. So they compensated for that with the wealth, with the IQ, and with getting themselves into these important positions. And they seem to have a knack for spotting things like the printing press and how important that can be with molding people's opinions and going all the way up to the newspapers, the mainstream media, Hollywood, and all these things. And yet it's only this tiny little group that have managed to do that. And of course, they boast about that in their own literature, and they'll say the Jews run Hollywood. But then when Gentiles notice it, then we'll be accused of being anti-Semites for pointing it out. I'm not anti-Semites. I'm fascinated by them. But what I am against is the corruption of my own people. I don't like seeing harm done to my own people, but I'm certainly not actually against Semites per se. What did we get into here? Do you want to add to that, Horace, at all?
Well, just about the last bit. I mean, I agree with everything you said before, just about anti-Semitism. I think it's really, really important. Whenever someone, I don't know if you get the chance, anyway, whenever someone tries to use that word against you, just ask them to define it, because there is no clear definition. And that's deliberate, I think, or that serves a function, at least. And I wrote an essay on McDonald's website, actually, the Occidental Observer. I wrote this essay last September. And I think it's still relevant. It's about the supposed anti-Semitism scandal in the Labour Party, which I think is a very, very sort of instructive episode. People can see this is under the name Morgan Jones. It's not my real name. It's called Labour's Fictitious Anti-Semitism Problem. And in that, I mentioned the importance of the word itself and how it's defined. I don't want to digress on it too much, but in certain senses, and I think Kevin MacDonald, I think at least in Separation and Its Discontents, presents the book as a discussion of the causes of anti-Semitism. He takes that word as fairly uncontroversial. I think it just means, you know, people who act against Jews. In which case, I mean, I would not necessarily deny, I mean, you know, not wholly deny that that word applies to me, because, I mean, I am against those Jews who aggress against us. And I think there's nothing controversial there. It's nothing we have to say in mealy-mouthed terms. You know, it's, you know, well, I am against bad Jews, and I think they're perfectly justified in being against bad whites. You know, so I mean, you know, like we've been sort of, I don't know, hoodwinked to some extent into thinking that we have to fight to be you know, not have that word applied to us. When you know, as with racist and Nazi, when you just sort of don't react in the way that they expect, the word loses a lot of its power, at least the sort of damnation quality of the word loses its power. And you can begin to, I mean, with a lot of this, some people are completely unreasonable, but with a lot of people, you can then enter into a far more frank and productive discussion.
We're against bad people. That's what we're against, and identifying these traits, basically, and how they affect us. Because when we live in a multicultural society, what's good for one person is going to be bad for another person. What's good for one group is going to be bad for another group. And we are constantly being told we need to be doing what is best for all the groups altogether. But when we do that, we're not doing what's best for our group. And particularly this benefits Jews, again, with this multicultural society. Things that are going to benefit the whole of society are going to benefit them, such as more immigration, but it's not going to benefit us. Speech laws, they're certainly not going to benefit us, but they do shield these other groups from criticism. And when you have a society that is mixed up of all these different groups, they're all going to be scrambling for power. All the minorities, because they are a minority, they're going to be trying to get as much power as they possibly can, because they're in this multicultural society and they're only a minority. That's only a natural way to be. That's why a multicultural society is not good for the majority in that society, the people that actually built that society, because it crumbles and it falls apart. And that's obviously, if you're a nationalist, you notice that, and you want to try and prevent that, and you want a nation that's going to be an ethno-nation, which is what the Jews have in Israel. But if you have an ethno-nation, by definition, that doesn't include Jews. They already have their own ethno-nation, so they're not a part of it. So that's why they're against nationalism for the host nations among which they live among. The next bit here that we have, how Judaism developed in antiquity. And it basically, it developed after the temple was destroyed, after the Jewish revolution that they had, which bore a lot of similarities to the Bolshevik revolution. They fought against the Romans. They lost against the Romans. The Romans themselves had tears in their eyes when they destroyed this feat of architectural engineering that was the temple. The Jews couldn't care less. The Jews were the ones that had actually set fire to it, because they were all the vagabonds from various different countries that had that had all converged upon Judea and become Jews. They were proselytizing at the time. You could just get circumcised and you could become a Jew. And there are all these terrible things that were going on, absolute depravities. So the Romans completely destroyed Jerusalem. They destroyed the temple. And after that, there was no more temple. There was no more priests. There was no more sacrifices. You had this new religion, Christianity, and the genuine people that were descended from Judah followed Christianity. They had left Jerusalem before this attack on Jerusalem took place with the Romans. And the group that was left behind after that then formed a religion based on bits of what they had learnt from the past, bits that they had from the Pharisees, and new bits that they thought up at the time that the rabbis thought up. And that became Talmudism. And that also taught them how to live amongst these other nations. And it made them very, very ethnocentric, told them that they're the chosen people. The people they're living among are just born to serve them. There are a lot of really horrible things in the Talmud about Gentiles and excusing things that the Jews can do to Gentiles, like they can lie to Gentiles. They don't have to give property back to them. That you can't have a Gentile testifying in court against a Jew. These things may sound horrible to us, but they're not horrible to Jews. They're a great benefit to Jews. I mean, Islam is similar. It says that Muslims mustn't bear witness against any other Muslims. So they shouldn't be in court bearing witness against someone else who is a Muslim. If they do, then they can be kicked out of the religion. Again, that's not good for Gentiles or Christians, but it's good for the Muslims. It's the same here. And so you had a very, very intense ethnocentric religion that really took place after, well, around about 500 AD is when the Talmud was actually written down. And they've managed to keep this religion going. And obviously they've raised up their rabbis and they've got their synagogues. And a lot of the time they had problems setting up these synagogues within Christian nations, because of the what was in their books, basically, what was in the Talmud. That got exposed in about 1100, 1200 AD, and there were popes that tried to get rid of it. But then by that time, you'd also had some of the Jews that had worked out that if they did join Christianity, pretty quickly they could work their way up to becoming advisors to it. And they were advising that the Pope should keep hold of the Talmud because that would help to understand the Old Testament. And the people that were trying to get rid of the Talmud and stop the synagogues being built, they actually lost out. And the Jews were able to keep the Talmud, and they were able to keep the synagogues being built. And William Luther was one of those that was trying to stop all of this, but they were unable to. And now we have the Jewish religion within our countries, and they used to have their separate bits, and they could only follow it in their, you know, in their shtetls, and they weren't allowed really to come out from there. But now everything is all mixed up together, and because of that, we've had to separate church from state, and we get all this anti-Christian stuff. And we think, where's the anti-Christian stuff coming from? Who could it be that doesn't like Christmas? And of course, it's all because of this Jewish religion that they have, which is entirely opposed to Christianity, which most Christians don't seem to understand. But I've gone on quite a bit here and gone off on a bit of a tangent about this. Do you want to make any comments on how Judaism developed in antiquity, the religion?
Well, yeah, as I understand it, E. Michael Jones and Douglas Reed also wrote fairly similar histories to that. And I noticed that early on in Jones's book, forgotten the title now, but his most famous one,
Jewish Revolutionary Spirit,
that's the one. Yep. He he says that Judaism, as you know, in terms of what we refer to by that word now, began around the time, or maybe shortly after Jesus. Like, not, you know, some people would speak of it as a thing that existed centuries or even millennia before Jesus, but Michael Jones says when he refers to Jews, he's talking about a sort of an identity that was formed specifically to, I don't know, defeat or bring down Christianity. It might be an overstatement, I'm not sure, but I think that's what he says early on in that book. And I'm not knowledgeable on that, but it's a very interesting theory, like that we should understand Judaism as it is now as something that is sort of, I don't know, some sort of antithesis to Christianity. The other thing I was going to pick up on, I can't remember actually. Sorry, no, move on.
Well, I was just going to say, E. Michael Jones tends to look at the spiritual side of this, and I think, and Kevin MacDonald looks at the psychological side of this. And E. Michael Jones' thesis is that when Christ came to earth and the Jews rejected Christ, Christ was also the Logos. So he was the order in the universe personified. So when they rejected Christ and they killed Christ, they rejected the order of the universe and killed the order of the universe. And they then became the agents of chaos and the agents of revolution from that moment on. And they've supported revolutions, and they've been a force in the world that is opposed to the force of Christianity. And this has been a lot of the history of the church since then. I'm looking at books that were exposing Freemasonry and Judaism from 100 years ago. They were saying that the Jews were seeking to supplant Christ. Christ was supposed to be the king of the world, the Messiah of the world, and the Jews wanted to take over the world as it was and enslave everybody and be at the heads of everything. And that is what it tells them they will eventually have in the Talmud. So, and then you get the rumors of conspiracies and all the rest of it. And there are conspiracies that go on, but there are conspiracies that go on in every aspect of society with every group in society. What Kevin MacDonald is on about is this instinctual drive that they have where they work in unison. That's the evolutionary strategy really that we're sort of concentrating on here. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, well, I think that's you touched on what is so valuable about MacDonald's work, because I personally have no problem with the conspiracy theories. You know, some of them are true, some are not. But it's often very superficial to look at things and just say, you know, why did this small cabal of people do this? And, you know, by no means do I don't agree with this sort of disparaging of conspiracy theories in general that some people have. I mean, often this is driven by Jews as well, to the point where they see David Icke as an enemy, even though he doesn't really talk about the Jews. But Kevin MacDonald obviously gives you a far more deep and sort of biologically and sort of, I don't know, scientifically based understanding of why these things happen. You can, compared to that, conspiracy sort of thinking is more superficial. So I think you get a richer and sort of more universally applicable understanding of these things from MacDonald's work, and that's part of why it's so valuable. And also, just I want to give a big shout out to Andrew Joyce as well, who's done so much to complement and add to MacDonald's work as well. He's just a brilliant scholar in his own right. The other thing I was just going to mention as well, what you said about the Logos. I'm not wholly convinced by what E. Michael Jones says about that. I mean, it's interesting. I've got to read that book again. I haven't properly read it. But Gilad Atzmon, who I mentioned before, is something that kind of corresponds to that. He speaks of Jerusalemite thinking and Athenian thinking, with Athenian thinking roughly corresponding to the Logos, but obviously without the... Well, I mean, Logos is a Greek word, obviously an Athenian word maybe, but without the Christian connotation. I think Atzmon himself is, I guess, an atheist maybe, I'm not sure. Where Jerusalemite thinking means basically obeying commandments. Like, you do this because you're told to, because it's been ordained from God above or the rabbi or whatever, depending on how actually sort of religious the person is. Whereas Athenian thinking... He identifies with, you know, rationality and curiosity and discovery for its own sake. I think that's a very interesting way of seeing things. So we live in a society now where Jerusalemite values prevail according to this schema, and Athenian values are sort of suppressed and demonized. And obviously, I would assume you and I and most of the audience probably want, to... tip the balance in favor of Athens again.
Well, yeah, Logos. That ties in with what E. Michael Jones says. I mean, he says what you have with Christianity, you have Hebrew religion, which was just given to them from above, as you say, it was just obey what you're told. And then you had that mixed together with the Athenian traditions, which was philosophy and which was talking about things and Plato and coming to realizations about things, about the natural world. And Christianity was a synthesis of that. So you had, basically the synthesis between Hebrew beliefs and Athenian beliefs, and that was original Christianity, whereas now obviously it's become corrupted. And quite clearly, I mean, Michael Jones is a promoter of going back to the Logos and how important that is to everything, and not being nihilistic and not being materialist. So I guess it ties in with what you're saying there with what Gilad Atzmon is saying about the difference between Athenian thinking and Jerusalem thinking. I guess the only difference would be that E. Michael Jones sees the synthesis of the two as being Christianity. And if Gilad Atzmon is an atheist, maybe he sees
it differently. That is quite a significant difference, actually. Maybe we can revisit that at some other point. I'd be interested. Yeah, so it's an interesting, that is probably quite an important difference, actually. And it's interesting, obviously, Atzmon, being of Jewish ancestry, has nevertheless embraced fully like Athenian thinking. He clearly praises that over Jerusalemite, and he sort of laments the rise of Jerusalemite thinking. If people want to see me, I've done a few interviews with Gilad. They're on my BitChute channel.
Yeah, I think I've heard a couple of them, some of the old ones. I don't think I've heard the newer ones. Number six here, other diaspora peoples. Now, it's important to say we're not singling out Jews here in particular. There are other groups of peoples that live among the nations, Gypsies, Han Chinese, and the Amish. And they've managed to retain their integrity and to gain influence to differing degrees. The Gypsies haven't really managed to retain or managed to gain much influence in society. They don't have an all-encompassing religion that keeps them together. Sometimes they marry out. They don't have a social idea that they have to marry other Gypsies or anything like that. They do have negative connotations to do with them. Lots of negative stories that are told about Gypsies. So,
yep. I mean, lots and lots and lots, even just from my own experience. Yeah.
Yeah. But then you can compare them to the Amish. And when you think of the Amish, you know, I think very highly of the Amish, and they're a nation within a nation. They have strong religious beliefs. They won't allow them to marry out. They have very different ways of doing things. No electricity, going around in their horse and cart. They're very traditional. They don't like education. They don't educate them more than with reading and writing, that is, beyond the age of about 13 or 14. They're told how to use their hands. And if you watch them erect a barn in 24 hours, it's just incredible to see. Yeah. And you draw a comparison between the Amish and the Gypsies. I mean, it's quite incredible. And yet they both are these nations living within another nation. It's just different ways of doing it, I guess.
One thing that Eric Kaufman mentioned in his book White Shift that I mentioned before was that whereas the white population, I think maybe in absolute terms, certainly in relative terms in America, is declining, you know, majorly, the Amish and perhaps one or two other, maybe something like Seventh-day Adventists, or one of the other Christian sects that lives quite separately. Maybe it's not the Adventists, but Amish and one of the others, maybe it's Mennonites, or I'm not sure, are booming in population, really, really successful in terms of their proliferation, proliferating rapidly. He compared them to the ultra-Orthodox in Israel. And I don't know whether he was joking or not, but he's like, we could be facing a future where Israel is majority ultra-Orthodox and not working. And the Amish become eventually, I mean, I think it means like a century or two, become the dominant group among whites in America. It's quite an interesting prospect.
That wouldn't be such a bad thing with the Amish becoming the dominant group. I mean, they reject feminism. Obviously, they reject contraception and abortion. That's why they have such large families. They stick with the traditional values, the same values that we all had 200 years ago. I think they're very admirable, the Amish. There's another group as well, the Han Chinese. And if we look at the Chinese and how they live among the other nations, the European nations, they have their Chinatowns. They marry other Chinese. They retain their language. They buy up properties. They help one another out. They're very, very ethnocentric, very business-minded. You actually have the Chinese government that helps them out. It sees these Chinese settlers that are in European countries. It sees the land that they take over as being part of China. It's now Chinese when they buy it. They buy up whole housing estates, and they will do that with money that's loaned to them by the Chinese government, because they see them see that as an outpost of China. So there's another group there. I don't know if there are any others. Can you think of any other nations that live within another nation, Horace?
I know that the Chinese are also the Chinese minorities tend to do very well in Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, and other countries around that part of the world as well. It's a similar pattern. I mean, some people even call them the Jews of the East or the Jews of Southeast Asia.
And they
no other groups spring to mind, but I'm sure there are a few, yeah.
They do also almost have a caste system there as well in places like Singapore. I mean, the Chinese would be on top, and the Malaysians, whose actual land it is, they're right at the bottom of the pecking order. They're the servants. Yeah.
Because Singapore is frequently spoken of as like a super free market state, but it's not true. Because of the Malaysians having much lower IQs and much lower abilities, there's an extensive welfare state to ensure that the society doesn't descend into an ethnic conflict. And they have positive discrimination for Malaysians and Malays in Singapore as well, for the same reason.
Now, I guess we see the elevation of the higher IQ there as well, with the Malaysians at the bottom of society and the Chinese at the top of it. Well, that's...
Yeah, there's a big difference. I think there's maybe like at least 10 or 15 points on average IQ in the difference between the two.
Yeah, I think Singapore's got the highest average IQ in the world, but that's not the Singaporeans. That's just the little island itself, strangely enough. it is multicultural, and it's actually a multicultural place that does work. It doesn't have the sort of crime that you see in the other multicultural areas. They have a very, very strict, almost like a dictatorship there. You know, you drop litter and you got a massive fine. If you get caught with drugs, you get hanged. If you break the law in a small way, you'll be publicly flogged. You know, they're very, very strict over there, but they don't have any crime.
I've visited Malaysia, which sort of surrounds Singapore. Like, Singapore's just a tiny little city-state that was sort of separated from Malaysia in the 40s. But in Malaysia, my impression was that, yeah, there's three distinct ethnic groups: the Chinese, the Malay people, and there's the sort of Indians and Pakistanis, or mostly Muslim Indians, I think. My impression was that all three communities just live separately. They cooperate to the extent that, you know, it enables them to have a state together. But they all, like, there's hardly any mixing whatsoever. That was my impression. I saw nobody who appeared to be mixed race. Nobody. I didn't see people visiting each other's areas. There were just a Chinese area there, an Indian area there, everywhere else Malaysian, because they're the majority. And basically the Malays have their way. But they allow the others to live there because it's economically beneficial to them, or just because, you know, actually to expel them would be quite a big thing. But it didn't seem like a particularly happy mix to them, to me. My impression was that, if that's what multiculturalism is, that's one more reason to avoid it, because it's just different people living alongside each other in one territory. I don't see any benefit to that whatsoever, apart from, you know, I mean, they can trade without living together, so that argument doesn't apply either.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, because you've got a smaller territory there, but you've essentially got the same thing going on that you would naturally you would have nations within their own territory, and the territory will be large enough to be a country. What you've got there is one country with three distinct ethnic groups in it, but they all live on their own territory within that group. And what you have in Europe and America, particularly in America, you've got this big drive to mix all the ethnic groups together. And we can't possibly have white people living on their own. We've got to have diversity there. We've got to have projects. We've got to have special housing. We've got to bring all the blacks in there and the Latinos in there and mix them with the whites. So, and that's what leads to the problems. So what you're outlining there in Malaysia is the opposite of that, really, isn't it? They've got their own territory and they stick in that territory, and they don't interbreed with the others. They stay with their own. It's
the deliberate drive to blend communities together and, you know, persuade, especially obviously whites, to mix with everyone, but also just everyone to mix with everyone in Western states. I see that, I might be wrong, but I see that as specifically Jewish driven. I think that that entirely fits with Jewish interests and nobody else's, as far as I can see. I don't think it's particularly good for blacks, let alone us. You know, I think that's what Jews want. That's Jews getting their way.
Well, it benefits them, doesn't it? In lots of different ways. I mean, it benefits them because it weakens the other nations around them. And it weakens the other nations because they lose their identity. If their offspring are mixed race, they don't have a heritage. They don't have an identity. They don't have a group identity, even with the parents, because they got one parent from one race and one parent from another race. So it weakens them in that aspect, and anything that weakens the other nations that the Jews are living among, the opposite of that is it strengthens the Jews. So their ethnocentrism is increased, while the ethnocentrism of the groups around them is weakened. So it is a benefit to them. And of course, we're told it's a benefit to us. It's a benefit to everyone. We should all want to interbreed with all the different races, and then there'll be no more racism. But that's a nonsense. What there'll be then is there'll be this one ethnocentric group ruling everybody else. And, you know, that's just the way the world is, isn't it? You have competition over resources. We have limited resources. And all the Jews are doing are very, very effectively competing for these resources. And we have seemed to have forgotten that that's what's going on. We're in the middle of a competition. You can't just hand everything over to these other groups, because eventually stuff is going to run out. It's limited. Territory, this, resources.
I really think this is the most important point at all. Like the problem, the white question, right? It's the, if pro-white activists can solve this problem, we can really reverse our fortunes and begin to sort of, as Jason Kona would say, recapture our destiny. It's to figure out, I mean, I assume that this is this tendency, that the thing that's so destructive, that makes us so vulnerable, is this white tendency to project universalism upon everyone else, to imagine that everyone else sees things in the universalist and egalitarian terms that we do. Well, I mean, I personally don't, but, you know, it's so prevalent among whites, you know, in the last sort of century. If I presume it has a biological basis. As I understand it, Kevin MacDonald has written about this in his latest book, I think, about sort of white altruism and what a weakness that is in a world where our you know, the borders of our countries are forced wide open. It means we're enacting altruism towards people who, by and large, many of whom despise us, absolutely despise us, or just see us as prey. So if we can, I assume that you can't literally just change that about white people. I presume that that is a biological susceptibility of ours. But if we can find some sort of way of organizing or of seeing ourselves, at least, you know, for a sufficient amount of time to achieve something, if we can organize in such a way as to overcome your bypass, or, you know, in some way negate the effects of that susceptibility and reverse immigration, not only will we be saved, but actually I think we'll be sort of acting in accordance with our nature, because it's not my desire to change what white people are. It's to free us from the danger. If it is, you know, part of our tradition to be altruistic and be high trust, and also to be welcoming to outsiders, i.e. outsiders within our own race, mostly, I don't see that as something that's lamentable about us. I think that's, if anything, something lovable, or at least not something to regret.
No, it's very good.
Sorry. No, you want to finish.
it's very good. I mean, that's why we were able to conquer the world, is because we were so altruistic to our own kind. That's why we managed to achieve all of this. The problem is it's now being extended to the out-group. So we need to separate from the out-group, and then our natural instincts will be helping us again instead of working against us. That's what's happened. These out groups are taking advantage of our virtues, basically. They will take advantage of our vices and our virtues, both of them. You know, that's what it boils down to. But yes, we're sort of coming up to the end here, Horace. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on today. That's been great. We've got through the first book there, and I'm hoping you'll come back on in 2 weeks' time to do the second one, Separation and Its Discontents. Next week, we have Isaiah coming back to talk to us about slavery in the South. So thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back on Friday with more Truthful Out Radio. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.